instead.
Yeah, if that's okay. Sorry, my wife's not here tonight. She's usually like my sound engineer that makes me make sure I have good sound. So I have kind of a loud voice, so I don't want to blow anyone out of the room. So it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you, Joan and Jimmy and Don. And it's a real pleasure to have followed my mentor, Robert. And it's great to be reading with Cheryl and Patricia as well. So I'm going to start off with a poem from my chapbook that I don't normally read out. It's about my sister who's dealing with an addiction issue, and she just kind of had a relapse, and it's a real mess. And so maybe by reading this poem, it'll send some good energy her way. It's called Intervention Concerto. My sister ends her bender in a detox I once dialed for her. And when left on hold, I press the earpiece close enough to dip my head into that canned loop of notes I hear as if they're being boiled down in some muddy back room. The once precise movement, now a symphony of tin cans, backed by catgut string and licorice stick, with a trickled out sound only an old cartoon could love. So I linger on the line, waiting to find a finger hold in this limbo lit with hard candy lights from cell towers and office phones, until my spent sister's chance at redemption starts to feel like all the helpless moments I've imagined playing out in the lives of others, ones that begin with a flashing ambulance and her being trucked away, always after midnight on a quiet street lit to an urgent red glow. These next couple are brand new ones. Some of them are looking for a home, as is my latest manuscript. It's called Living on the Margins, and I'm a gardener. Start most of my crops by seed, and it's always a great, the springtime comes and then you get stuff in the ground, and the critters that deserve the earth as much as we do start to get to them, and it can be a little bit frustrating, but it's called Living on the Margins. With sunlight shouldering its way through the locust leaves at dawn, I watch from the bathroom window as a chestnut doe and her three spotted fawns nibble a patch of poison ivy before pawing through our compost heap, where just yesterday I'd buried eggshells, juiced limes, and tooth-marked melon rinds, not far from where they bed, another narrow tree line where backyards touch. Last night, I fell asleep troubled over a student squatting in a vacant north side house. And while I slept, a squirrel chewed through a kitchen screen, left a Honeycrisp peeled to its core, while a whitetail topped an ox heart and a groundhog mowed my Brussels down to bitter stems, needing bark and brassica to keep his teeth from growing. A squirrel really did chew through my kitchen window and ate an apple. This next one, I've lived on Perry Highway, Route 19, which is kind of an interesting road in that it goes literally from Florida all the way up to Lake Erie. And so just the idea of living on this this two-lane highway for so many years has been just interesting. And the one thing I had noticed living on there is there's backhoes that drive up and down the road from time to time, and it's just a kind of a strange phenomenon. So it's called Dwelling on Perry Highway. Side-porched near midnight, sneaking a smoke when that yellow backhoe rumbles by to quarry another rusted water line out of the cold, wet earth, somewhere off this two-lane stretching from the Gulf Coast to Lake Erie. The machine, dipper tucked and folded, front loader hinged and raised a shade, bug-eyed headlamps lighting away north, its big, bouncy back tires steadily churning across asphalt, a dozen cars trailing in its diesel-fueled wake. Let's Let's see. These next couple are going to be restaurant poems. As Joan mentioned, I'm a veteran of the service industry. And aside from being a jagoff or being cheap, the worst thing you can do as a patron in a restaurant is to stick around after closing when people are trying to go home. But it is just one of those things. This poem's called The Communicants. Here, Tuesday stumbling towards midnight, we're stuck with that lone couple lingering over a last swallow of Pinot. Their plates cleared, water glasses emptied, check unsettled. They don't care that the closing cook has swept and mopped his now dark kitchen, where the dish machine cools among bottles of bleach, where the last call was given long ago. Instead, they lean in and whisper while we sip water and try not to stare, soaking up the flicker of a muted TV, feeling forgotten like those doggy bags we pack but get left behind. And if work can be worship, it finds us supplicant and waiting for the chirp of chairs pushing back from their table, followed by heels clicking on hard wood, a recessional marking the end of service, the front door closing like a prayer, quiet on its hinges. Thanks. The wonderful thing about working in restaurants has been the exposure to people, certainly the guests that you take care of, which can be interesting. You can meet some really cool people. Over the years that I've met, that I've become friends with and have mentored me in some ways. But also the idea of a kid from Carnegie who didn't really know a damn thing about the world, starting to work at an Italian restaurant that unfortunately burned down a few months back, Papa J's, really exposed me to different types of people that I hadn't previously been exposed to back in the late 1980s. So this is called Gratitude. Those first nights bussing tables at the local red sauce spot, I humped greasy plates to the kitchen and eyeballed love-worn waitresses who paid me no mind. It was the waiters who made damn sure I moved with purpose, setting the silverware straight, slicing lemons into wedges with care. In spotless Oxfords and spit-shined shoes, aprons cinched at the waist, they smoked before the dinner rush, dishing out tales of slinging drinks on the Vegas red eye, bragging about landing a double Lutz while skating Smurf clad in the ice capades. All of us buzzing from laughter by the time service began. And even though the cooks joked about them liking little boys, and Holy Rollers that year hyped God's wrath for the coming plague, those men tipped well and taught me to fold napkins into swans, to powder cornstarch on skin rubbed raw, to rescue luster with a touch of vinegar, scrubbing the parquet floors at shift's end until my palms grew pickled. They did it for the dipshit who could down a dozen strohs during a woodsy kegger, then gun for cheap thrills, mocking, lisping, limp-wristed, and swishy, as only a straight kid from Pittsburgh could. This next one is a poem looking for a home. Another really cool thing, I haven't met a ton of celebrities, but I did get to shake hands with Bruno Sammartino a couple years back. So this poem is called The World Feels Small After Shaking Hands with Bruno Sammartino. How comforting Milgram's 6 degrees of separation between any two people, residents of a winding venue in the widening web of our relations. And on a slow night at the bistro, servers play the Kevin Bacon game for hours, connecting random celebs to the one-time footloose actor, the center of the universe for those who dabble in relative distance and fame. I'll think of this as I shake hands with the legendary pro wrestler I'm waiting on, only 2 degrees from Schwarzenegger, 3 from a Kennedy, 5 from Alfred Hitchcock and Orson Welles. And when the Irish writer tells me about showing Arthur Miller the sights of Belfast, all I'm interested in is this link to overdose and assassination. The closest I come to conspiracy, a New Orleans bar stool where Oswald once sat and a shady landlord with mob ties. Over the years, I found myself sweating beside others in hot restaurant kitchens. A few of them will succeed at murder, suicide, or dying in their sleep. A strange pride wells up when I come across their names in the paper. So I stand 2 degrees from Jimmy Snuka, 3 from Andy Warhol, 4 from Edward Teller, and consider the misfortunes of some I've known. The girl who jumped from a bridge, the boy who died from a jealous lover's fire, until I'm linked with a friend who panhandles after losing his sight to a mugger outside the 7-Eleven. It feels like rubbernecking. Thank you. As I was putting these together, somehow I have two, I don't own this vehicle anymore, but two poems about the former red pickup that I used to have. It's kind of, the first one's sort of about my dad as well. Proper maintenance. This red pickup is a listing heap with one tire like a bitten donut. Each crank of jack on pebbly driveway brings blood to my flayed knuckles. Heavy lug nuts make my shirt pockets sag. As wheel slides from axle, I battle gravity to a brief draw while dropping the metal rim on the grass. I'm sweating in the early April sun, bold strokes of black grease smearing my flannel and jeans. The old truck contains a litany of repairs. Its underside rattles on left turns, tailpipe hacks at acceleration. Its glove box fills with papers, itemized bills detailing cost of procedures and GM parts. This is my inheritance, overseeing thinning memories of my dad. We had beers at the Eagles Club, and later he drives me home. It was springtime, windows rolled down, the one time we rode in it together. And this is another restaurant poem that features the same red truck. It's called Cadre. On Fridays, I drive a ginger-haired friend to work, another restaurant gig we landed years before his first DUI. And for 10 minutes, we trade tales of our aging parents, their homes and bodies failing, forgetting how they once told us we could be anything. Our promise rusted as my red pickup that rumbles into this back lot where air reeks of grilled meat and dried sweat, where busboys on break light one stale smoke after another, and a cook rubs his last dime over a stack of instant wins. Tonight, what we've come to bear beneath chandeliers built of driftwood will be those bad dreams of endless loads and slick floors, suffered until we wake, bone-tired and thirsty. Come midwinter, my weariness, a mouthful of motherfucker, spit when my truck gets trapped in the driveway's icy grooves, and like a child in tantrum, all I can do is rock my body and spin the wheels into a cry. I'm going to finish up with two more restaurant poems. I lived in New Orleans for a year, and that was a great time. I think I was a little too young to appreciate it the way I was supposed to, but the idea of bars being open 24 hours a day was pretty interesting to a 23-year-old. It's called Two Drink Minimum. When John T. shotgunned joint smoke past my lips at the party where everyone spoke at once, not eating a thing, it was green of me to not think I'd been kissed. His last name's gone to me now, even as I first met him, on his back, spitting through his mustache, twitching on the tan-tiled kitchen floor. My first days wearing red and white stripes, suspenders not yet decked with flare pins. His black cap lying crumpled and tossed aside while burgers go cold and the fryer keeps sizzling away. At Golden Lantern, weeks later, John T. tells me he's a laid-off auto worker from Flint. He goes by Alice, a nickname Lucille, the bald barkeep, gave him in this gay bar that sounds like a dance party and never closes. A place where a sobriety token can buy you a rum and coke. And I know I'm far from Pittsburgh when days after, on my way down Royal Street, I'll find him snoring in a doorway. Thin, pink-faced, and goggle-eyed, he weaves his way to work, a place he calls a two-drink minimum, that being what it takes to get him through the heavy double doors. At 40-something, his body's a hollowed-out haywire of epilepsy and HIV. When he cleans out the book bag he calls home, a dozen empty Gilby's pints clink inside. When he refuses the meds, he blames them for shitting himself on the uptown streetcar one night. I forget now the lies I told myself about what I was doing for that year and the quarter, but mostly I listened to denial as it gathered in a pool of sweat beneath melted cocktails, headwater to the tiny rivers we floated upon. And I'm going to finish up with the title poem to my chapbook, Argot. This poem was featured in a documentary called Eating and Working, and Eating and Working by the local filmmaker David Bernabo. So it's out there. If you ever want to check it out, it is a documentary about the lives of service industry workers that I obviously think is pretty well done. So, Argot. In the sweaty restaurant kitchen where I'll learn to cuss in Mexican, tattooed line cooks talk shit in voices nicked as the bone-white monkey bowls we stack and fill. They call the boss and picky customers chupacabra, goat sucker being the inside joke for every pain in the ass. Years ago, in a place once a mustard factory, I was a boy touring mom's latest food prep gig. A windowless world where the clam chowder paddled around in vats deep enough for me to stand, and I wore a paper hat, same as the mustached men in bloody aprons who cut up and kitted while they hacksawed T-bones from beef sides. Now I dig 12-hour grooves of full trays and spaghetti joints with family names. I keep ice bins full and counters clean, wondering at times if the routine has replaced the oxygen of my dreams with a working life that takes what it wants, stealing my pen and handing me bad math on credit slips. On her days off, Mom wants to play Scrabble, but instead we talk about our fingers, how they've split into open-flowered nerves, stinging our bodies to the bulk of a weary self at the end of the day, each of us searching for the phrase that captures what it is to feel at once both capable and small. Thanks so much, folks.